Are you cause or effect, Warshawski, the way the bodies are piling up around you?
Today on KPR Presents, the popular detective V.I. Warshawski comes to Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre, and on today's program, Sarah Paretsky is the author of the best-selling V.I. Warshawski detective series. The latest in that series, Fallout, has our Chicago-based detective traveling to the Sunflower State. Welcome, Ms. Paretsky.
Hi, it's great to be back in Lawrence.
Let's start with a quick plot overview. V.I. takes on a missing persons case that starts in a suburban Chicago gym. It involves a young filmmaker and an elderly former actress and brings them to Fort Riley and then to Lawrence. No spoilers here, but can you take it from there?
The reason that the book is set in Kansas, and this is not a spoiler because it ends up not playing a serious role in the story, but my dad was a cell biologist on the Hill and did that for his entire professional career from 1951 until he died, really, in 2000. And in the 60s and 70s, during the Cold War, some of his research really was on the fringes of biological warfare. He worked with an organism that was similar to what the Soviets were trying to weaponize. They were trying to weaponize the organism that causes typhus, and the one that he worked on causes Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So he went to a big conference. He had wanted to study their strain of it, and of course they were never going to let an American scientist look at what they were doing. But he went to a big conference in Czechoslovakia in the 60s, and he somehow persuaded one of the technicians in the Czech bioweapons lab to inject him with the strain of their organism. And he came back to Kansas City. He got off the plane with a fever of 104. He didn't start antibiotics until his lab tech had come and taken a blood sample from him so that he could culture it. I want to say that people on the TWA flight that he was on were not at risk because it's transmitted by fleas or ticks, not directly person to person. So unless the plane was filled with fleas and ticks, everyone else was safe. But that episode, I never knew why he did it. I don't know whether really the U.S. Army put pressure on him to try to bring it back, whether it was just his sort of stubborn determination to study it, or he was in many ways a, let's just say, very unusual person who had no use for authority in any form. And it may have just been that he wanted to prove that he could thumb his nose at the entire Soviet military and police apparatus and smuggle this thing out under their very noses. So I'll never know. But when I started thinking about a book that might have something to do with bioweapons, which this book in some ways does, but it had to be set in Kansas because I couldn't imagine anything with that kind of work anywhere else. I mean, it could have taken place anywhere in the country, I suppose, but to me, its home was here in Kansas on the Hill. So I had to get V.I. out of Chicago, and that led to the missing actress, who's an African-American woman in her late 70s, maybe early 80s. And that also gave me, I hadn't started the story meaning to do that, but it gave me a chance to explore my perspective on race relations in Lawrence, which I didn't know much about when I was growing up, but I've learned more about since moving away.
This is your 18th V.I. Warshawski novel, but the first in which she travels to Kansas. Why did it take so long to get V.I. to your old stomping grounds?
I don't think I ever thought of her as operating in Kansas. And I originally was imagining this book more as a standalone novel without her. I had done one standalone, Bleeding Kansas, that I published 8 or 9 years ago, and I kind of wanted to write more about this part of the world just because I think as I get older, I don't know that it's nostalgia necessarily, but as you get older and you look at the arc of your life, your earliest experiences begin to take a certain shape and become more what you want to look at and study, maybe. But I couldn't persuade my publishers or my agent that a standalone novel would sell any copies. And I'm not a huge risk taker with my career. I need to make a living. And so when no one would give me a contract for the standalone novel, I decided I would figure out a way to get VI here.
You'd mentioned your previous book, Bleeding Kansas, which I had the pleasure of interviewing you back in 2008 about that book. In what way was it different for you writing about Kansas for VI versus if it had been some other protagonist?
That's a really good question, Kay. I think that in some ways it would have been harder and easier. Harder because VI is so much part of my own skin and bones, so to speak, that I won't say this was an easy book to write. I've written 20 novels, and only the fourth was easy to write. But her voice and her take on the world are just second nature to me. It's like putting on your most favorite pair of shoes that look nice, but you can really walk around. And I don't have that pair of shoes, but I, mythically, in my fantasy life,
all have that pair of shoes in our imagination.
But it was harder also because I think of Lawrence and I think of Chicago in two very different ways. And Chicago's been my home for 50 years, but it's 50 adult years. Lawrence was my home for my first 20 years, my coming of age years. I went to Caw Valley District 95, a two-room school, and I'm not sure what they're doing with it now. For a while, it was some fancy prep school, but it's something else now. And then I went to Lawrence High and did my undergraduate degree at KU. So it's in some ways, my sort of patriotic sense of place is really Lawrence, and it's really Kansas, despite the many problems and issues that I know Kansas and Lawrence and the university all face. So it was hard to bring in an outsider from the big city, and I took me a number of months, probably 3 or 4 months of working on the novel before I really felt that she belonged in this space. I think in a way, she comes to Fort Riley first because the actress that she's looking for, Emerald Faring, Emerald was born there. Her father was with the 1st Infantry, which is stationed at Fort Riley. And he was shipped out and died at the Battle of the Bulge. She was born there while he was already dead. So I had VI stop there to try to find information about her. One of the things, the flood of 1951, the great flood that anybody who's older, my age or older, remembers, I didn't realize until I was doing research, it displaced a quarter of the Kansas population. It just staggered me, and it completely obliterated all of the barracks at Fort Riley. So the fort was totally rebuilt from ground up after the flood. So I got obsessed with it for a while. I was consulting old maps and trying to get information from the War College in Fort Leavenworth and so on. I wanted to know whether housing for African American soldiers had been segregated. It didn't seem to me that it was, although I sort of also couldn't believe that it wasn't. But I never could really get that information. But none of that exists anymore. None of the housing that would have stood in the 40s is there in Fort Riley anymore.
You just mentioned that although you grew up in Lawrence, you've lived in Chicago for 50 years. I'm wondering if some of VI's observations about Kansas and Lawrence reflect your own observations when you come back home from the big city.
One of the things that VI notices is the ubiquitous Jayhawk, And I put that in as a just as a marker, just because that Jayhawk is everywhere. But what can I say? I love the Jayhawk. My brothers and I, we were half joking when our dad died, and he was very dedicated to KU. We thought, could we get the baby Jay to come to his funeral and do do a few tricks? But we decided the rest of the extended family might not find that as cherished a moment as we would. But some of, I think some of the way that VI looks at Lawrence is like the flip side of the way I look at Chicago, because I came to Chicago as an outsider, and I saw things that people who grew up there don't really ever see. I mean, some of it's banal details, like you ride the elevated trains in Chicago, and you see wildlife, you see foxes, you see pheasants, and I don't think people really look out the windows and look at it, but it all was startling to me, or drunks asleep on the roof. That was all just part of the urban experience that natives are inured to and don't really notice. And so VI comes to Lawrence, and she notices the homeless people, which actually I find very shocking here, because that wasn't part of the town when I was growing up and when I left, but it definitely is now part of the Lawrence landscape.
Much of the book is set in Lawrence, but you acknowledge in your introduction that you've taken some liberties with the town and its geography. In what way does VI's Lawrence look different than our Lawrence?
I've created a United Church, a Congregational Presbyterian Church, on the banks of the Kaw, and I've inserted that. If you go down Kentucky Street to where it bends and turns west, I've added some land there up on the bluff, and it's a church. I actually created it in Bleeding, Kansas, and didn't really think through the geography when I created it for Bleeding, Kansas. This book, I spent a lot of time just hiking around, and my brother Jonathan, who still lives here, we drove around. There's a part of the book where a truck goes into the Wakarusa River, and Google Maps does not show you how that might be possible. In fact, you think it might be impossible, and I wrote a whole bunch of chapters about that, and then I came here, and Jonathan took me out, and we actually hiked down there, and I had to rewrite all that because I'd just gotten every detail wrong. Message there for writers who think they can do all their research online. No, when you are writing about the Antarctic, you must go to the Antarctic, because otherwise people who live and work there will tell you all the mistakes you made. So that was one thing. And then I added a missile silo to Douglas County, the Kanwaka missile silo. And I put that, my family lived out east on 15th Street. We were actually in the Eudora Township. We're not far from Pendleton's Country Market, which many listeners I'm sure know. So I've added about a quarter mile land in between the Pendletons and the next farm, and then stretched the distance a little bit to K-10, between old K-10 and new K-10, and I've put this missile silo in there. And that was another fascinating thing for me with the research that I did for this book, was all these, I mean, we all knew we were expendable growing up in the 50s and 60s, that they put the missile silos where there weren't a lot of people, and Kansas, along with the rest of the Midwest, is dotted with them, and it's like, oh yeah, you know, they don't care if we're fried, because there are not a lot of us and we don't count. And it just always kind of made me grow up feeling a little belligerent about my value to the United States. But many of these silos, after President Reagan and Premier Gorbachev made their historic weapons disarmament agreement in now I can't remember the year, but in the 80s, many of these missiles were decommissioned. The nuclear warheads were taken out and taken apart and taken down to their components and hopefully stored someplace safe. But the empty silos now, many of them have turned into meth labs. And that's one of the things that people wonder if that's happening in the Kanawha silo that I've plunked in Douglas County. But some of them have been turned into these survivalist condos, which just leaves me scratching my head. Like, you can buy for about $1.5 to $2 million, you can buy a condo underground that will supposedly, I mean, I guess it would get you through a nuclear attack because the silos were built to withstand an incoming missile from the Soviet side. But, oh man, who wants to be there underground? But they feature imported granite countertops made in Germany. You get a 5-year free supply of freeze-dried food with your purchase of this condo. And the part that just leaves me really scratching my head, or actually guffawing, is that there's guaranteed Wi-Fi. And I'm thinking, right, after Armageddon, the internet will still be up and running. Who really believes that? But I guess the person who wants to spend $1.5 million on an underground condo. So there's a good business to go into, I guess, is buying old missile silos from the government with it going cheap and turning them into expensive survivalist condos.
You can keep that in mind just in case this book thing doesn't work out for you.
Right, I know.
There are so many local references in Fallout. You mentioned the big flood of 1951, the filming of the movie The Day After here in Lawrence in 1983, street names and local landmarks. There's even a clever nod to Lawrence High School in the name of a fictitious downtown bar.
Oh,
the
you
Lions
saw that.
Pride.
Thank you. I did name it for LHS.
How much fun is it to write a story set up in the town where you grew up?
Well, it was a lot of fun to put in those little local flourishes. And then I love really good espresso, and Lawrence has an amazing number of good coffee bars. And my personal favorite is the Bourgeois Pig. But I was told early in my career never to use the name of a real place if you were setting action there, because you may think that you're writing favorably about them, but they may not think that. So I created my own place called the Decadent Hippo. Which has they sell t-shirts that shows a big pink hippo sitting in a cappuccino mug or cup. And that's where VI goes for her morning coffee, and then she goes there at night to drink whiskey. And this is something where she travels down here with her golden retriever Peppy. Her current lover, Jake, the bass player, he's not happy with her because he's just tired of being in love with someone who's always putting herself at such high physical risk. And he's gone off to Switzerland with his music group, and he wants VI to come. He wants her to take a break and, you know, try to change her life, do something new, do something more fun, more adventurous. And she's always... And she says no, she's insulted and hurt that he doesn't think her work is worthwhile. But she's always making these snide remarks under her breath about, well, I could be in Basel, Switzerland right now eating hand-knit chocolates. But my publisher didn't want hand-knit chocolates, but it's the only way, I think, the only word that describes your obsession with perfect locavore, artisanal, organic. It's all, someone is sitting there just carefully hand-knitting it all. Anyway, so she's down here with her dog, Peppy, and the Decadent Hippo. She says, would you believe that she was an emotional support animal? And they say, oh, sure. It's November. It's chilly. It's spitting rain half the time.
What does bringing the dog along do for VI that she couldn't do on her own?
I'm not sure why in the beginning I had her bring the dog. It just seemed too lonely to me to be coming here on her own. Mr. Contreras, her downstairs neighbor who's in his 90s, he's gone off to the Virgin Islands with I think it's a niece, maybe it's a cousin. Isn't that terrible that I can't remember now what I myself wrote?
I think it was a niece.
Anyway, yeah. Yeah, his wife's niece. And so VI is feeling, well, she doesn't need to stay there to look after him. Jake has gone to Switzerland. She's just really lonely. And Pepe will bring her some warmth and comfort. But then as I was working on the book, I'm not someone who does outlining or plots in advance. I know where I want to be, but I don't know how to get there. And so there's a lot of writing, discarding. And there's this famous line from Chekhov that if you have a gun on the mantle in Act 1, it has to be used in Act 3. So halfway through, I thought, well, Pepe's here. That means that she has to play a role. And so I have her play a very dramatic role that I'm not going to describe because that really is a spoiler.
I think also the presence of the dog grounds VI in giving her, she's off solving a crime, but she also has this being that she needs to attend to. And it's kind of this reminder that, oh, right, I can't just go off hunting for, you know, these missing people. I need to walk the dog, or I need to figure out what to do with the dog. The dog's been in the car too long. And it's kind of this constant grounding her in the real world of responsibilities that of a more personal nature. And it also gives her someone to talk to.
Right. She and Pepe have intense conversations, as I do with my dog. But that I'm glad it strikes you that way. I always worry that there's just a little bit too much dog in my books. And of course, I do have a couple of friends who don't like dogs. Hard as it is to believe that, I personally have friends who do not like dogs. They were so happy when, in one book, Lottie doesn't particularly want the dogs around and makes them stay out of her apartment. And they were cheering when Lottie firmly drew a line against dog presence.
You and V.I. Warshawski have been companions for 35 years now. How has she changed over the years? And is it hard to keep her fresh?
One of the things that has changed with her, well, there have been a number of changes, but when I started the series, I had the idea that she should age in real time, because who she is really a product of the social justice movements of the 60s and 70s, and also who she is shaped by her mother's experience of being a refugee or an immigrant. Back before we had so many legal hair-splitting ideas of what a refugee was, her mother fled from the race laws in Mussolini's Italy and ended up in Chicago, and that also had a profound effect on who V.I. was. But as time has passed, and I was 30 when I started the series, or in my early 30s, and I couldn't imagine that I'd be the age I am now, and I couldn't imagine what my body would feel like. And I don't do a quarter, I don't do 5% of the things with my body that VI does with hers. But she's much more robust than I am physically, that's for sure. But even so, I decided for her to stay active at the level that I want her to be, her aging has slowed way down. So I was 34 when I started, and I'm 69 now. VI was 30 when I started, and she's 50 now. So she's better than I am in so many ways, including not needing to age as quickly as I do. I think one of the things that I cannot seem to get a handle on is that she was a lot more insouciant when I started the series. And I'm someone who is hyper-responsible, and I don't like being hyper-responsible, but I am. And, constantly worrying about this person's welfare and needing to take care of that cause or program. And I think my worrying has bled over into VI in a way that I don't like, but I, especially because it's a first-person narrative, it's really hard for me to draw a line and make her a more carefree, thumbing her nose kind of person.
Is she more like what you would like to be?
Is she more like what I would like to be? I feel that there are risks that I am hoping I will take before I get too decrepit to keep writing, that there are risks with my writing that I don't take. And she really will jump off that high dive. There are many aspects of her life that I don't admire or wish to emulate, but that's the one that I think is, that's my desideratum, the thing that I wish was true for me.
One of my favorite scenes in Fallout is one in which she's describing just going about her day and how much of the day that she's spending changing clothes. She's in jeans and a turtleneck, and then she puts on her, you know, her professional suit, and then she throws on a sweatshirt and goes out for a run. And once I noticed that, I really started noticing V.I. spends a lot of time changing clothes.
And fortunately, these are 21st century clothes. I read a memoir about, it was a book that came out about a decade ago, a memoir that this man wrote about his family in Austria before the Second World War. They collected Netsuki, I'm not going to say it right, but the tiny Japanese carvings. And that was all that was left of their sort of enormous personal fortune and art collection after the Nazis were through with them. But he describes his maternal grandmother's day changing clothes, and she had affairs. And these clothes, you needed a maid to button and unbutton everything. So it really took hours. And then she would keep a duplicate outfit where she was having the affair, just so that she didn't have to spend so much time. Now I can't remember why a duplicate outfit would cut time from the dressing. And never mind. But at least with VI and people like me, it can take you under 5 minutes to throw it all off and throw it all on again, and which is what I did before I came down to the studio. I looked at myself in the mirror. I thought, I know this is radio, but I can't look quite so much like I just crawled out of a dumpster.
You look smashing, by the way.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, today on KPR Presents, it's Sarah Paretsky. She's the author of the popular V.I. Warshawski detective series. The latest in that series, Fallout, brings the Chicago-based detective to Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. When you go on a book tour like this one for your book, Fallout, what are the challenges for you on the road as you're pitching your book to people who have followed your career for decades, as well as people who may be newcomers to VI?
Being on the road, being on tour, I love doing events, but I wish that you could do it so that you were doing one event a week instead of seven events in 6 days. The travel is just extraordinarily challenging, and I'm now at the point where I can't find things in my luggage. Like this morning, I couldn't find my hairbrush, and that took an extra half hour of packing and unpacking, and it's like, oh. I don't know why, as the tour progresses, it becomes harder to keep track of these
little
things.
That doesn't surprise me at all. Just being a bit of a traveler myself, usually, you know, a couple weeks in, you don't know where anything is.
Right. And I think you just sort of disintegrate as you're further and further from your home base. But, people's response to VI is something that means an enormous amount to me. And this tour in particular, I was in Columbia, Missouri yesterday, where actually at the start of my program, I revealed that my brother Jonathan's first complete sentence, actually his second complete sentence, was "beat Mizzou." And I told him this, and he said, "Oh, way to try to grow your sales, sis." And now I can't remember why I revealed that particular anecdote. Oh, right. I was doing a program on, not on the Mizzou campus, but there's a what was originally a women's college right next to Mizzou called
Stevens College.
And they have this wonderful Unbound Literary Festival. This is their second year, and it's just, I don't know where they get the money. It's all volunteer because they had Salman Rushdie as their keynote speaker. And then they brought about 20 of us in to do panels and programs. But I met so many young people who actually were reading my books and responding to them. And it was, I know this just sounds vain and narcissistic, but actually because I am older now and I just wonder sometimes whether I'm just writing for people my age. And it was just really heartening to know that even though VI is older than probably than their moms at this point, that there's still something in the books that can speak to a young person. So it means that I feel like I have a real responsibility to always do my best job, both as a writer and when I'm in public, so that I don't disappoint the people who've been gracious enough to support me.
When you started the character of VI, did you mean for her to be this groundbreaking detective that was so unlike the other female characters we saw in literature?
I very much started wanting to create a woman who did not, who turned a lot of the existing stereotypes on their head. So especially in crime fiction, noir fiction, women who were sexually active were by definition wicked. Tom Toper wrote a book called Coda, and the opening sentence was, "The trouble began in bed." And you know from that opening sentence that the woman is the villain. You don't have to read the whole book. And then if the woman was sexually chaste, she couldn't tie her shoes without adult supervision. So I wanted someone who was just an ordinary person in the sense that, yeah, she had a sex life, but it didn't determine her moral character. And she could solve problems, as men and women both have to do, unless they're in some extraordinary circumstance where they can call on the butler to solve the problem for them. And she could hold her own in a street fight, which meant she was not a karate expert. It meant she had grown up in a rough and tumble neighborhood and learned to use her elbows to good advantage. So those were all things that either were in me or that I observed from the neighborhood that I was living in Chicago. And I very much wanted her to be that person. And I guess I didn't realize quite how novel she was until time passed and the readership grew and I started hearing from people about that. I think one of the other things that one of my other takeaways from yesterday in Columbia was with the students was also painful in a sense, in that a lot of the books that they're reading now, the women were telling me they just felt hadn't changed that much. The books by men where the only role for women was to be sexually available or to be, you know, to be there when some particular service, either sexual or meeting some other physical need, came along. And one young woman had been a judge for best thriller of the year for the International Thrillers Association, and she said every book, even by very highly reviewed and touted male writers, reduced women still to this kind of subservient role. And I don't know, I just, that really gets me down, that all the work that we've been doing over the last 45 years trying to change, make women more equal at the table, even in President Obama's West Wing, and I'm a huge fan of President Obama, but nonetheless, the women would have to get together before a meeting and agree that they would all reinforce what each other said just so that someone would pay attention to their point of view. I don't know. I think that maybe that's what we have to do. We have to get on board for each other, but it's just really frustrating that we're still in that place, that even though we're on the Supreme Court or we're police officers or university professors, that it's still, as one of my nieces who's a physician said, it hasn't been said until a man says it. And that is just disheartening.
has the fact that there are more women writers of detective novels, has that changed at least those characters that they're writing?
I think for many of them it has. For some, it hasn't. There's a real trend over the last 5-10 years for quite violent, sadistic pornography. And I'm thinking of writers like Mo Hayder in England, you know, she has a serial killer who's skinning women and turning their flesh into parchment and writing messages on it. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe you're trying to make a statement about female empowerment that you can write this, but to me it feels pretty violating and boundary crossing. But I think what has changed, first of all, there are quite a few male writers creating wonderful empathic women characters that didn't exist to, it always existed, but not nearly to the degree it does now. And we have really grown the audience for mysteries. So when I helped get Sisters in Crime going, one of the first things that we did to try to get more attention paid to books by women was we had our own books in print that we would take to libraries and to bookstores, and they would start carrying our books, which they didn't know about because they weren't getting reviewed in the same way that men's books were. We did a study, and we found that a crime novel by a man was 7 times more likely to get a review in a national publication than a crime novel by a woman. So we started just finessing that situation and going directly to buyers and to librarians. And over the years, we have heard from so many women saying that they never read mysteries until they started discovering books by women or by men who kind of were willing to create women who were people, not just objects. And in publishing, which, like so much of the rest of print life in America, journalism and so on, you know, book sales are down and so on and so forth, but the crime novel continues to be very buoyant. And when you look at the New York Times bestseller list, you'll find that crime fiction is occupying probably half of the 10 top spots any given week. And a lot of that is really due to women readers coming back to the form and feeling that their personalities are now being reflected, their experience is now being reflected.
Who are you reading now?
I'm reading a Swedish writer who is new to me named Helene Tursten. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly. She has a police detective, police inspector in the Swedish town of Göteborg who is a lot like Donna Leon's inspector, in that her family life is a really significant part of the story. She's married, she has twin daughters, and so trying to keep a work and family responsibility balance, it's not something that I ever tried to do with VI, who doesn't, you know, she looks after her dogs, but that's not nearly as challenging as having twin daughters who may have maybe getting involved with bad boys or doing who knows what, coming home with shaved heads when they come home in one book, and she has to cope with that. So I find that a really interesting series. I'm also reading more general fiction than I used to, and the book that's just really gripped me lately, that it's The Invisible Bridge by Julie Orrington. Came out about a decade ago. It won a ton of awards and might even have won the Pulitzer for fiction that year. I put it off and put it off because it's a bit of a personal, it's like a family story that she's fictionalized about her own family's experience in Hungary during the Second World War. But the writing is just gorgeous. I'm loving that book.
Most people know of your work as the author of V.I. Warshawski, and perhaps they're familiar with some of the other stories you've written, but a lot of our listeners might not be familiar with the nonfiction work you do. Talk to me about that.
Well, it's been a good 8 years ago now, I guess, that I published a collection of essays called Writing in an Age of Silence, And it's a sort of a memoir. I don't really have any hobbies, which is, I think, a true failing, because it means that I'm either looking after my household and my husband, whose health is a bit frail, or the dog, who refuses to go for walks with anyone but me. She's a brat. VI's dog is so much more responsive and well-behaved. But, I mean, so I'm always working, either, you know, and then I'm politically active, which I don't really enjoy. I just feel compelled to be, because I feel like when I was 10, my parents felt I was much too intense and that I needed to see what dire fate awaited girls who were too intense. And so they gave me Mark Twain's personal recollections of Joan of Arc to read, thinking that seeing her burned at the stake would make me think, oh, I should just be...
lighten up a little.
Right. And instead, it kind of left me with this lifelong feeling that, number one, I needed a big mission, and number two, I needed to be immolated. So I'm running a Facebook page now called Sarah Paretsky and Friends Act for Justice, and I'm thinking maybe that's going to move me a little bit closer to that pile of dry wood in the market square at Rouen. But the memoir is a sort of an interplay between some of the things that I've really struggled with: finding a writer's voice, finding the courage to have a public presence, and my personal history and the way that my personal history intertwined with events like the civil rights movement, like second wave feminism. And people have asked for new essays, but I don't feel right now that I'm ready to write them. I think I need to think more about my experiences, or think about them in a different way than I really have time to do right now. I did a PhD in American history at the University of Chicago, and that was 40 years ago. And suddenly last year, for whatever reason, they decided they wanted to publish my dissertation, which was on, it was an intellectual history of change in intellectual kind of mindsets, underlying intellectual theories of the universe, really, that took place in New England in the 1830s and 40s as geology and philology upended long-standing ideas about the age of the earth and the way the Bible came to be written. And that topic, I think, is more relevant today even than it was when I wrote it, because of the way in which Bible-based Christianity has come to play such a significant role in American public life. I did not have the time to update the research, so I've always felt a little embarrassed that they published it as is, because it really should be fleshed out more, and there's been 40 years of new work done on this, and a lot of different ways of thinking about it, and a lot of family history that I didn't know at the time that would have played into it. I learned long after I'd finished the dissertation that the wives of some of the men that I was studying had actually been Hebrew scholars and had done a lot of the translating work that they were never credited with. I learned this through some family correspondence that I came on. So there were a lot of ways in which I wish that I had the time to upgrade it, but that I knew that just wasn't realistic.
Getting back to your latest book, Fallout, could I have you read an excerpt?
Sure. So I'm just going to read a little bit. VI has discovered a dead body in an old farmhouse, not unlike the house that I used to live in, and at a location not dissimilar to where my family home, still called the Gilmore House for the family that lived there before we bought it. And she is back in Lawrence with the sheriff, whose name is Gisborne, and he is named for the sheriff of Nottingham, whose name was Gisborne. And he is talking to her. So this is not based on any real Douglas County sheriff. So please do not be offended that the sheriff is a little bit confrontational with my heroine. Everyone is confrontational with her because she's confrontational.
I was just going to say, before we get to feeling too sorry for VI, she dishes it out and she as well as she takes it.
Marilyn Stasio reviewed Fallout for the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, and she said, not VI, but that I was fierce with a chip on my shoulder. And I thought, well, Marilyn, you're probably right. And that's probably why VI is fierce with a chip on her shoulder. So she's found this dead woman in my family home. She's found the daughter of a KU faculty member who's living on the streets, passed out under a iron stairwell at the Lion's Pride Bar at 8th and Rhode Island. And local law enforcement officers are just starting to wonder. The local Lawrence police officer that she works with, whose name is Everard, says, are you cause or effect, Warshawski, the way the bodies are piling up around you? So the dog persuaded you to enter, the sheriff said when we were back in town, and you turned on the lights, even at the risk of tampering with the crime scene. I had my temper on a lead as tight as the one I'd kept on Peppy. A rat about as big as your size 13s was nibbling on the victim's nose. It seemed disrespectful to keep the lights on, not to let the vermin do any more damage than they already had. The sheriff kept asking questions, but they were time markers, just to show that he was in charge. Why was I in Kansas? Why had I gone to the McKinnon farm? Why had I gone into the house? None of it was relevant, but Gisborne wanted to know why it was I who had found Sonia Keel, what I'd said to Randy Marks at St. Raphael's, the group home where Sonia lived. Sheriff, I interrupted. A Buick Enclave has been showing up around me off and on today. I wondered how you knew I'd been to see Mr. Marks, so I thought perhaps you were following me. I'm not, but maybe I should, the way you're stirring the waters, Gisborne said. Marks called me. You're in a small town now, Warshawski, not the big city. We all know each other. We all look out for each other. You may think you're moving around stealthily, but everyone knows where you are and what you eat for breakfast. Well, that's good. If you decide to lock me up, you'll know just what to bring me. I'd forgotten I wasn't going to bait him. Since you're on me like my underwear, you know I was at the hospital. Did you know that neither of Sonia Keel's parents has been to see their near-dead daughter? That's just what I mean, Warshawski, Gisborne said heavily. You don't know squat about these people. Sonia forfeited her right to parental regard a long time ago. I nodded slowly, as if he'd said something particularly meaningful. Before she passed out, Sonia said she'd seen Emerald Faring in the place where Matt Chastain lies buried. Where is that? Gisborne's eyes darted around the interrogation room as if a good answer might be posted on one of the walls next to the don't spit or smoke in here signs. If those friends of yours were staying out at Doris McKinnon's farm, you need to get them in here to answer questions about her murder. Sheriff, I said gently, number one, I've never met them. They're not my friends. I'm here in your county looking for them. Number two, this means you've identified the body and the means of death already, which is massively impressive. I'm going to get the Cook County Medical Examiner to phone your pathologist so he can find out how you did this in 3 hours. I'll put it out on my Twitter feed. That is not for public consumption. His phone rang, sparing us both further escalation. He picked it up, snapped his name into the mouthpiece, but put it against his chest while he told me not to leave his jurisdiction. Must not bait the sheriff. Must not bait the sheriff, I chanted to myself. Oh, I wouldn't dream of it, Sheriff. I'm having way too much fun here.
That's Sarah Paretsky reading from Fallout. It's her 18th V.I. Warshawski novel. Sarah, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you, Kay, for your interest. I really appreciate it. How about if I give a plug for supporting your local radio station?
Go.
Hi, this is Sarah Paretsky. I live in Chicago now, but I grew up in Lawrence. I'm a donor to Kansas Public Radio, and I hope you will be too.
You heard it here. Pledge your support for Kansas Public Radio and programs like KPR Presents at our website, kpr.ku.edu. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. For the rest of this hour, author Sarah Paretsky talks about her only other book set in Kansas. Bleeding Kansas was published in 2008. Paretsky gave a talk about that book and her life as a writer at the Lawrence Arts Center. This excerpt was originally broadcast on KPR Presents on August 31st, 2008.
Well, I've been on the road around the country with Bleeding Kansas since January 2nd. And as my tour winds down, I'm finally returning to the scene of the crime. During the month that I've been in such amazing cities as Houston, Phoenix, and Madison, Wisconsin, I've had email messages from any number of Lawrencians, past and present, who say that they've seen themselves or D.A. Vern Miller or Sheriff Rex Johnson in the characters of Elaine Logan or Arnie Chapin or even Arnie's perfect red heifer, Nassie. I know that it's futile for me to say that all of these characters are figments of my imagination, that the only real person any of them is based on is me, because they represent different aspects of my own personality. As my brother Jonathan explained to me yesterday, we are all of us as readers bring our own lives and experiences to what we read, so that in a very real way, we are always present in someone else's novel. I do understand that, sort of, anyway, but really, everyone in Bleeding Kansas is made up. Of course, some of the things in the novel are reality-based, including the old Fremantle Paretsky Gilmore house. I also benefited greatly from John and Karen Pendleton's willingness to open their farm to me. Whether I got very many details right about farming is certainly open to question, but I came away from my time with them much impressed by not just the constant round of work, but the amount of creative thinking that has to go into successful farming. Thanks, too, to Karen, I am a proud honorary member of the Meadowlark chapter of 4-H. I based all of Laura Grelier's 4-H projects on what I saw this very impressive bunch of kids doing for the fair. I couldn't make a desk. I couldn't identify the 3,000 beetles of northeastern Kansas. I couldn't build a raft out of old discarded plastic water bottles, but those are just a few of the things that my fellow chapter mates have been doing. The Chapins and the Greliers, the two farm families who make up the heart of my story, occupy an extra half mile of land that I added between Lawrence and Eudora. Now, I did want Putnam, my publishers, to include a map of Douglas County in the overleaf, but they refused to add to the expense of printing the book by doing that detailed cartography, especially since it would have meant freehand drawing in the extra half mile. Now, the Greliers, my sort of main family, my hero family, they do crops, but the Chapins are dairy farmers, and I did spend a very small amount of time on an organic dairy farm near Topeka. When I was 11, I read Dracula. This book completely terrified me. I think that was the start of my lifelong hobby of insomnia. It was many, many, many nights before I slept. I kept patrolling the house, looking outside for vampires. And as you may know, vampires can take the form of wolves, and then they'll jump through your window, break the glass, and then they'll turn back into vampires and suck your blood. Well, one night around 2 a.m, as I was patrolling the perimeter, I looked out and there they were, wolves in the back garden. I screamed really loudly and woke both parents and four brothers who all came running and looked out and they were actually cows. The famous vampire cows of Douglas County. So the neighbor's cows had knocked over the fence and they were eating my mother's corn. I have to confess that someone who cannot tell the difference between a wolf and a cow is probably not ideally equipped to write about a dairy farm, but I gave it my best shot. All of these points raise the question of what is the crossover between experience and fiction? What's real? What's imagined? And how can you possibly distinguish between the two? So that's what I'm going to sort of discuss tonight, or try to discuss. Every story has its roots in the life of the writer. You do your best, most sincere work when you mine your own experience and then detach yourself from it and turn it to story. What makes Stephen King's horror novels so compelling and so convincing is that that's what's really going on inside his head. And while I envy him his success, I am very glad I don't have his nightmares. I believe we all turn our experiences into stories as we try to make sense of them, whether we're writing them down the way I do, or whether we're telling them to a friend or a partner, or whether we're just reciting them endlessly in our head in the dark. We use stories to understand life. How a writer works, what time we get up, do we use a computer or a pencil? All those nuts and bolts are different for each person. There's no right way mechanically, physically to write. There's just the way that works for you. But we only do, we writers, what everyone is doing. Turn life into stories, and then turn stories into a way of understanding life. When I was 4, my dad found a job here at the University of Kansas. My older brother and I didn't want to move from our friends with whom we acted out the recently ended Second World War in the drainage ditch behind our house. And especially, we didn't want to leave the Good Humor truck, which brought us fudgesicles on summer nights. I guess the search for chocolate has been one of the enduring constants of my life experience. You know, when you read about the biographies of the really great writers, Faulkner, Chandler, they were terrible drunks. There's a wonderful story about Faulkner and Hammett bullying their way into a dinner party at Bennett Cerf's and then both of them passing out as soon as they crossed the threshold. They could revive Faulkner long enough to prop him up at the table, but Hammett they had to bundle into a taxi and send back to his apartment. Edgar Allan Poe was a substance abuser. Wolfe and Plath were teetering over the edge of mental stability. You just never hear about a really great writer who was found headfirst in a bucket of hot fudge. Which makes me feel that I am actually a complete dilettante. Eat your way out of that one.
That's Sarah Paretsky, author of the popular V.I. Warshawski detective series. KPR has a copy of her latest book, Fallout. If you'd like a chance to win a copy, leave a comment on KPR's Facebook page. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.